awful, was it? She slept fine, Sarah. She really wore herself out yesterday. I don't know that I've ever had a more determined patient. She stabbed a hard finger into Kelly's chest. You've helped a lot, young man. Kelly looked away, not knowing what he was supposed to say. The pleasure was all mine? Part of him still believed that he was taking advantage of her. He'd stumbled upon a troubled girl and exploited her? No, that wasn't true. He loved her. Amazing as that seemed. His life was changing into something recognizably normal, probably. He was healing her, but she was healing him as well. She's worried that I won't... The stuff in her past, I mean. I really don't care much about that. You're right, she's a very strong girl. Hell, I have a somewhat checkered past, too, you know. I ain't no priest, guys. Let her talk it out, Sam said. She needs that. You have to let things in the open before you start dealing with them.
You're sure it won't affect you?
It might be some pretty ugly stuff, Sarah observed, watching his eyes. Uglier than war? Kelly shook his head. Then he changed the subject. What about the medications? The question relieved everyone, and Sarah was talking work again. She's been through the most crucial period. If there were going to be a serious withdrawal reaction, it would have happened already. She may still have periods of agitation, brought on by external stress, for example. In that case, you have the phenobarb, and I've already written out instructions for you, but she's gutting it out. Her personality is far stronger than she appreciates. You're smart enough to see if she's having a bad time. If so, make her take one of the tablets. The idea of forcing her to do anything bridled Kelly. Look, Doc, I can't... Shut up, John. I don't mean jamming it down her throat. If you tell her that she really needs it, she's going to listen to you, okay? How long?
For another week, maybe 10 days, Sarah said after a moment's reflection.
And then?
Then you can think about the future you two might have together, Sarah told him.
Sam felt uneasy getting this personal. I want her fully checked out, Kelly. When's the next time you're due into Baltimore?
A couple of weeks, maybe sooner. Why?
Sarah handled that. I wasn't able to do a very thorough exam. She hasn't seen a physician in a long time, and I'll feel better if she has a CPX, complete history and physical.
Who do you think, Sam?
You know Madge North?
She'll do, Sarah thought.
You know, Kelly, it wouldn't hurt for you to get checked out, too.
Do I look sick?
Kelly held his arms out, allowing them to survey the magnificence of his body.
"Don't give me that crap," Sarah snapped back. "When she shows up, you show up. I want to make sure you're both completely healthy, period. Got it?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"One more thing, and I want you to hear me through," Sarah went on. "She needs to see a psychiatrist."
"Why?"
"John, life isn't a movie. People don't put their problems behind and ride into a sunset in real life, okay?" She's been sexually abused. She's been on drugs. Her self-esteem isn't very high right now. People in her position blame themselves for being victims. The right kind of therapy can help to fix that. What you're doing is important, but she needs professional help too, okay?
Kelly nodded.
Okay.
Good, Sarah said, looking up at him.
I like you. You listen well.
Do I have a choice, ma'am? Kelly inquired with a twisted grin.
She laughed. No, not really.
She's always this pushy, Sam told Kelly. She really ought to be a nurse. Docs are supposed to be more civilized. Nurses are the ones who push us around.
Sarah kicked her husband playfully.
Then I better never run into a nurse, Kelly said, leading them back off the dock.
Pam ended up sleeping just over 10 hours, and without benefit of barbiturates, though she did awaken with a crushing headache, which Kelly treated with aspirin.
Get Tylenol, Sarah told him, easier on the stomach.
The pharmacologist made a show of checking Pam again while Sam packed up their gear. On the whole, she liked what she saw.
I want you to gain 5 pounds before I see you again.
And John's going to bring you in to see us so that we can get you completely checked out. 2 weeks, eh?
Yes, ma'am.
Kelly nodded surrender again.
But
Pam, they ganged up on me. I have to go in, too, Kelly reported in a remarkably docile voice.
You have to leave so early?
Sarah nodded. We really should have left last night, but what the hell? She looked at Kelly. If you don't show up, like I said, I'll call you and scream.
Sarah, Jesus, you're a pushy broad.
You should hear what Sam says. Kelly walked her out to the dock, where Sam's boat was already rumbling with life. She and Pam hugged. Kelly tried just to shake hands, but had to submit to a kiss. Sam jumped down to shake their hands.
New charts, Kelly told the surgeon.
Aye, Captain.
I'll get the lines. Rosen was anxious to show him what he'd learned. He backed out, drawing mainly on his starboard shaft and turning his hatteras within her own length. The man didn't forget. A moment later, Sam increased power on both engines and drove straight out, heading directly for water he knew to be deep. Pam just stood there, holding Kelly's hand until the boat was a white speck on the horizon.
I forgot to thank her, Pam said finally.
No, you didn't. You just didn't say it, that's all.
So how are you today?
My headache's gone. She looked up at him. Her hair needed washing, but her eyes were clear, and there was a spring in her step. Kelly felt the need to kiss her, which he did.
So what do we do now?
We need to talk, Pam said quietly. It's time.
Wait here.
Kelly went back into the shop and returned with a pair of folding lounge chairs. He gestured her into one. Now tell me how terrible you are. Pamela Starr Madden was 3 weeks shy of her 21st birthday, Kelly learned, finally discovering her surname as well. Born to a lower working-class family in the Panhandle region of northern Texas, she'd grown up under the firm hand of a father who was the sort of man to make a Baptist minister despair. Donald Madden was a man who understood the form of religion but not the substance, who was strict because he didn't know how to love, who drank from frustration with life, and was angry at himself for that too, yet never managed to come to terms with it. When his children misbehaved, he beat them, usually with a belt or a switch of wood until his conscience kicked in, something which did not always happen sooner than fatigue. Never a happy child, the final straw for Pam had come on the day after her 16th birthday, when she'd stayed late at a church function and ended up going on what was almost a date with friends, feeling that she finally had the right to do so. There hadn't even been a kiss at the end of it from the boy whose household was almost as restrictive as her own. But that hadn't mattered to Donald Madden. Arriving home at 10:30 on a Friday evening, Pam came into a house whose lights blazed with anger, there to face an enraged father and a thoroughly cowed mother.
The things he said. Pam was looking down at the grass as she spoke. I didn't do any of that. I didn't even think of doing it, and Albert was so innocent. But so was I, then.
Kelly squeezed her hand. You don't have to tell me any of this, Pam. But she did have to, and Kelly knew that, and so he continued to listen. After sustaining the worst beating of her 16 years, Pamela Madden had slipped out her first-floor bedroom window and walked the 4 miles to the center of the bleak, dusty town. She'd caught a Greyhound bus for Houston before dawn, only because it had been the first bus, and it hadn't occurred to her to get off anywhere in between. So far as she could determine, her parents had never even reported her as missing. A series of menial jobs and even worse housing in Houston had merely given emphasis to her misery, and in short order she'd decided to head elsewhere. With what little money she'd saved, she'd caught yet another bus, this one Continental Trailways, and stopped in New Orleans. Scared, thin, and young, Pam had never learned that there were men who preyed on young runaways. Spotted almost at once by a well-dressed and smooth-talking 25-year-old named Pierre Lamarck, she'd taken his offer of shelter and assistance after he had sprung for dinner and sympathy. 3 days later, he had become her first lover. A week after that, a firm slap across the face had coerced the 16-year-old girl into her second sexual adventure, this one with a salesman from Springfield, Illinois, whom Pam had reminded of his own daughter, so much so that he'd engaged her for the entire evening,
paying Lamarck $250 for the experience. The day after that, Pam had emptied one of her pimp's pill containers down her throat, but only managed to make herself vomit, earning a savage beating for the defiance. Kelly listened to the story with a serene lack of reaction, his eyes steady, his breathing regular. Inwardly, it was another story entirely. The girls he'd had in Vietnam, the little childlike ones, and the few he'd taken since Tisha's death. It had never occurred to him that those young women might not have enjoyed their life and work. He'd never even thought about it, accepting their feigned reactions as genuine human feelings. For wasn't he a decent, honorable man? But he had paid for the services of young women whose collective story might not have been the least bit different from Pam's, and the shame of it burned inside him like a torch. By 19, she'd escaped Lamarck and three more pimps, always finding herself caught with another. One in Atlanta had enjoyed whipping his girls in front of his peers, usually using light cords. Another in Chicago had started Pam on heroin, the better to control a girl he deemed a little too independent. But she'd left him the next day, proving him right. She'd watched another girl die in front of her eyes from a hot shot of uncut drugs, and that frightened her more than the threat of a beating. Unable to go home, she'd called once and had the phone slammed down by her mother even before she could beg for help, and not trusting the social services which might have helped her along a different path, she finally found herself in Washington, D.C., an experienced street prostitute with a drug habit that helped her to hide from what she thought of herself, but not enough. And that, Kelly thought, was probably what had saved her. Along the way, she'd had two abortions, three cases of venereal disease, and four arrests, none of which had ever come to trial. Pam was crying now, and Kelly moved to sit beside her. "You see what I really am?" "Yes, Pam, what I see is one very courageous lady." He wrapped his arm tightly around her. "Honey, it's okay. Anybody can mess up. It takes guts to change, and it really takes guts to talk about it." The final chapter had begun in Washington with someone named Roscoe Fleming. By this time, Pam was hooked solidly on barbiturates, but still fresh and pretty-looking when someone took the time to make her so, enough to command a good price from those who liked young faces. One such man had come up with an idea, a sideline. This man, whose name was Henry, had wanted to broaden his drug business, and being a careful chap who was used to having others do his bidding, he'd set up a stable of girls to run drugs from his operation to his distributors. The girls he bought from established pimps in other cities, in each case a straight cash transaction, which each of the girls found ominous. This time, Pam tried to run almost at once, but she'd been caught and beaten severely enough to break three ribs, only later to learn of her good fortune that the first lesson hadn't gone further. Henry had also used the opportunity to cram barbiturates into her, which both attenuated the pain and increased her dependence. He'd augmented the treatment by making her available to any of his associates who wanted her. In this, Henry had achieved what all the others had failed to do. He had finally cowed her spirit. Over a period of 5 months, the combination of beatings, sexual abuse, and drugs had depressed her to a nearly catatonic state until she'd been jarred back to reality only 4 weeks earlier by tripping over the body of a 12-year-old boy in a doorway, a needle still in his arm. Remaining outwardly docile, Pam had struggled to cut her drug use. Henry's other friends hadn't complained. She was a much better lay this way, they thought, and their male egos had attributed it to their prowess rather than her increased level of consciousness. She waited for her chance, waiting for a time when Henry was away somewhere, because the others got looser when he wasn't around. Only 5 days earlier, she'd packed what little she had and bolted. Penniless, Henry had never let them have money. She'd hitched her way out of town. "Tell me about Henry," Kelly said softly when she'd finished. 30. Black, about your height. Did any other girls get away?" Pam's voice went cold as ice. "I only know of one who tried. It was around November. He killed her. He thought she was going to the cops, and... She looked up. He made us all watch. It was terrible.
Kelly said quietly, "So why did you try, Pam?"
"I'd rather die than do that again," she whispered, the thought now out in the open. "I wanted to die. That little boy. Do you know what happens? You just stop. Everything stops. And I was helping. I helped kill him."
"How did you get out?"
"Night before, I fucked them all, so they'd like me. Let me out of their sight. You understand now?"
"You did what was necessary to escape," Kelly replied. It required every bit of his strength to keep his voice even. "Thank God."
"I wouldn't blame you if you took me back and set me on my way. Maybe Daddy was right what he said about me."
"Pam, do you remember going to church?"
"Yes."
"Do you remember the story that ends, 'Go forth and sin no more'? You think that I've never done something wrong? Never been ashamed? Never been scared? You're not alone, Pam. Do you have any idea how brave you've been to tell me all this?" Her voice by now was entirely devoid of emotion.
"You have a right to know."
"And now I do, and it doesn't change anything." He paused for a second. "Well, yes, it does. You're even gutsier than I thought you were, honey."
"Are you sure?"
"What about later?" "The only later thing I'm worried about is those people you left behind," Kelly said.
"If they ever find me..."
Emotion was coming back now. Fear.
"Every time we go back to the city, they might see me."
"We'll be careful about that," Kelly said.
"I'll never be safe, never."
"Yeah, well, there's two ways to handle that. You can just keep running and hiding, or you can help put them away." She shook her head emphatically.
"The girl they killed, they knew. They knew she was going to the cops. That's why I can't trust the police. Besides, you don't know how scary these people are."
Sarah had been right about something else, Kelly saw. Pam was wearing her halter again, and the sun had given definition to the marks on her back. There were places which the sun didn't darken as it did the others. Echoes of the welts and bloody marks that others had made for their pleasure. It had all started with Pierre Lamarck, or more correctly, Donald Madden, small, cowardly men who managed their relations with women through force. "Men?" Kelly asked himself. "No." Kelly told her to stay in place for a minute and headed off into the machinery bunker. He returned with 8 empty soda and beer cans, which he set on the ground, perhaps 30 feet from their chairs. "Put your fingers in your ears," Kelly told her.
"Why?"
"Please," he replied. When she did, Kelly's right hand moved in a blur, pulling a 45 Colt automatic from under his shirt. He brought it up into a 2-hand hold, going left to right. One at a time, perhaps half a second apart, the cans alternatively fell over or flew a foot or two in the air to the crashing report of the pistol. Before the last was back on the ground from its brief flight, Kelly had ejected the spent magazine and was inserting another, and 7 of the cans moved a little more. He checked to be sure the weapon was clear, dropped the hammer, and replaced it in his belt before sitting down next to her. It doesn't take all that much to be scary to a young girl without friends. It takes a little more to scare me. Pam, if anybody even thinks about hurting you, he has to talk to me first. She looked over at the cans, then up at Kelly, who was pleased with himself and his marksmanship. The demonstration had been a useful release for him, and in the brief flurry of activity, he'd assigned a name or a face to each of the cans. But he could see she still was not convinced. It would take a little time. "Anyway," he sat down with Pam again. "Okay, you told me your story, right?"
"Yes."
"Do you still think it makes a difference to me?"
"No. You say it doesn't. I guess I believe you."
"Pam, not all the men in the world are like that. Not very many, as a matter of fact. You've been unlucky, that's all. There isn't anything wrong with you. Some people get hurt in accidents or get sick. Over in Vietnam, I saw men get killed from bad luck. It almost happened to me. It wasn't because there was something wrong with them. It was just bad luck,
being in the wrong place, turning left instead of right, looking the wrong way. Sarah wants you to meet some docs and talk it through. I think she's right. We're going to get you all fixed up.
And then? Pam Madden asked.
He took a very deep breath, but it was too late to stop now.
Will you stay with me, Pam?
She looked as though she'd been slapped. Kelly was stunned by her reaction.
You can't. You're just doing it because...
Kelly stood and lifted her by the arms. Listen to me, okay? You've been sick. You're getting better. You've taken everything that goddamned world could toss at you, and you didn't quit. I believe in you. It's going to take time. Everything does. But at the end of it, you will be one goddamned fine person.
He set her down on her feet and stepped back. He was shaking with rage, not only at what had happened to her, but at himself for starting to impose his will on her.
I'm sorry. I shouldn't have done that. Please, Pam, just believe in yourself a little.
It's hard. I've done terrible things.
Sarah was right. She did need professional help. He was angry at himself for not knowing exactly what to say. The next few days settled into a surprisingly easy routine. Whatever her other qualities, Pam was a horrible cook, which, failing, made her cry twice with frustration, though Kelly managed to choke down everything she prepared with a smile and a kind word. But she learned quickly, too, and by Friday she'd figured out how to make hamburger into something tastier than a piece of charcoal. Through it all, Kelly was there, encouraging her, trying hard not to be overpowering and mainly succeeding. A quiet word, a gentle touch, and a smile were his tools. She was soon aping his habit of rising before dawn. He started getting her to exercise. This came very hard indeed. Though basically healthy, she hadn't run more than half a block in years, and so he made her walk around the island, starting with 2 laps, by the end of the week up to 5. She spent her afternoons in the sun, and without much to wear, she most often did so in her panties and bra. She acquired the beginnings of a tan, and never seemed to notice the thin, pale marks on her back that made Kelly's blood chill with anger. She began to pay more serious attention to her appearance, showering and washing her hair at least once per day, brushing it out to a silky gloss, and Kelly was always there to comment on it. Not once did she appear to need the phenobarbital Sarah had left behind. Perhaps she struggled once or twice, but by using exercise instead of chemicals, she worked herself onto a normal wake-sleep routine. Her smiles acquired more confidence, and twice he caught her looking into the mirror with something other than pain in her eyes. "Pretty nice, isn't it?" he asked Saturday evening, just after her shower.
"Maybe," she allowed.
Kelly lifted a comb from the sink and started going through her wet hair.
"The sun has really lightened it up for you."
"It took a while to get all the dirt out," she said, relaxing to his touch. Kelly struggled with a tangle, careful not to pull too hard.
"But it did come out, Pammy, didn't it?"
"Yeah, I guess so, maybe," she told the face in the mirror.
"How hard was that to say, honey?"
"Pretty hard." A smile, a real one with warmth and conviction. Kelly set the comb down and kissed the base of her neck, letting her watch in the mirror. Kelly got the comb back and continued his work. It struck him as very unmanly, but he loved doing this. "There, all straight, no tangles."
"You really ought to buy a hairdryer."
Kelly shrugged. "I've never needed one." Pam turned around and took his hands.
"You will if you still want to."
He was quiet for perhaps 10 seconds, and when he spoke, the words didn't quite come out as they should, for now the fear was his.
"You sure?
Do you still..."
"Yes."
It was hard lifting her with wet hair, still nude and damp from the shower, but a man had to hold his woman at a time like this. She was changing. Her ribs were less pronounced. She'd gained weight on a regular, healthy diet. But it was the person inside who had changed the most. Kelly wondered what miracle had taken place, afraid to believe that he was part of it,
but knowing that it was so. He set her down after a moment, looking at the mirth in her eyes, proud that he'd helped to put it there.
"I have my rough edges, too," Kelly warned her, unaware of the look in his eyes.
"I've seen most of them," she assured him.
Her hand started rubbing over his chest, tanned and matted with dark hair, marked with scars from combat operations in a faraway place. Her scars were inside, but so were some of his, and together each would heal the other. Pam was sure of that now. She'd begun to look at the future as more than a dark place where she could hide and forget. It was now a place of hope.
Chapter 6. Ambush. The rest was easy. They made a quick boat trip to Solomon's, where Pam was able to buy a few simple things. A beauty shop trimmed her hair. By the end of her second week with Kelly, she'd started to run and had gained weight. Already she could wear a two-piece swimsuit without an overt display of her rib cage. Her leg muscles were toning up. What had been slack was now taut, as it ought to be on a girl her age. She still had her demons. Twice Kelly woke to find her trembling, sweating, and murmuring sounds that never quite turned into words, but were easily understood. Both times his touch calmed her, but not him. Soon he was teaching her to run Springer, and whatever the defects in her schooling, she was smart enough. She quickly grasped how to do the things that most boaters never learned. He even took her swimming, surprised somehow that she'd learned the skill in the middle of Texas. Mainly he loved her, the sight, the sound, the smell, and most of all the feel of Pam Madden. Kelly found himself slightly anxious if he failed to see her every few minutes, as though she might somehow disappear. But she was always there, catching his eye, smiling back playfully. Most of the time. Sometimes he'd catch her with a different expression, allowing herself to look back into the darkness of her past, or forward into an alternate future different from that which he had already planned. He found himself wishing that he could reach into her mind and remove the bad parts, knowing that he would have to trust others to do that. At those times, and the others, for the most part, he'd find an excuse to head her way, and let his fingertips glide over her shoulder, just to be sure she knew that he was there. 10 days after Sam and Sarah had left, they had a little ceremony. He let her take the boat out, tie the bottle of phenobarbital to a large rock, and dump it over the side. The splash it made seemed a fitting and final end to one of her problems. Kelly stood behind her, his strong arms about her waist, watching the other boats traveling the bay, and he looked into a future bright with promise. "You were right," she said, stroking his forearms.
"That happens sometimes," Kelly replied with a distant smile, only to be stunned by her next statement.
"There are others, John, other women Henry has... like Helen, the one he killed."
"What do you mean?"
"I have to go back. I have to help them. Before he kills more of them."
"There's danger involved, Pammy," Kelly said slowly.
"I know. But what about them?"
It was a symptom of her recovery, Kelly knew. She had become a normal person again, and normal people worried about others.
"I can't hide forever, can I?"
Kelly could feel her fear, but her words defied it, and he held her a little tighter.
"No, you can't, not really. That's the problem. It's too hard to hide."
"Are you sure you can trust your friend on the police?" she asked.
"Yes, he knows me. He's a lieutenant I did a job for a year ago. A gun got tossed, and I helped find it. So he owes me one. Besides, I ended up helping to train their divers, and I made some friends."
Kelly paused.
"You don't have to do it, Pam. If you just want to walk away from it, that's okay with me. I don't have to go back to Baltimore ever, except for the doctor stuff.
All the things they did to me, they're doing to the others. If I don't do something, then it'll never really be gone, will it?"
Kelly thought about that, and his own demons. You simply could not run away from some things. He knew. He'd tried.
Pam's collection was in its way more horrible than his own. And if their relationship were to go further, those demons had to find their resting place.
"Let me make a phone call."
Lieutenant Allen, the man said into his phone in Western District. The air conditioning wasn't working well today, and his desk was piled with work as yet undone. Frank? John Kelly, the detective heard, bringing a smile. How's life in the middle of the bay, fella? Wouldn't I like to be there? Quiet and lazy. How about you? The voice asked. I wish, Allen answered, leaning back in his swivel chair. A large man, and, like most cops of his generation, a World War II veteran, in his case a Marine artilleryman, Allen had risen from foot patrol on East Monument Street to homicide. For all that, the work was not as demanding as most thought, though it did carry the burden associated with the untimely end of human life. Allen immediately noted the change in Kelly's voice.
What can I do for you?
I met somebody who might need to talk with you.
How so? The cop asked, fishing around in his shirt pocket for a cigarette and matches.
It's business, Frank. Information regarding a killing. The cop's eyes narrowed a bit while his brain changed gears.
When and where?
I don't know yet, and I don't like doing this over a phone line.
How serious?
Just between us for now. Allen nodded, staring out the window.
That's fine, okay.
Drug people. Allen's mind went click. Kelly had said his informant was somebody, not a man. That made the person a female, Allen figured. Kelly was smart, but not all that sophisticated in this line of work. Allen had heard the shadowy reports of a drug ring using women for something or other. Nothing more than that. It wasn't his case. It was being handled by Emmett Ryan and Tom Douglas downtown, and Allen wasn't even supposed to know that much.
There's at least 3 drug organizations up and running now. None of them are very nice folks, Allen said evenly.
Tell me more.
My friend doesn't want much involvement. Just some information for you, that's it, Frank. If it goes further, we can reevaluate then. We're talking some scary people if this story is true.
Allen considered that. He'd never dwelt upon Kelly's background, but he knew enough. Kelly was a trained diver, he knew, a bosun's mate who'd fought in the Brownwater Navy in the Mekong Delta, supporting the 9th Infantry. A squid, but a very competent, careful squid, whose services had come highly recommended to the force from somebody in the Pentagon, and who'd done a nice job retraining the force's divers. And, by the way, earning a nice check for it, Allen reminded himself. The person had to be female. Kelly would never worry about guarding a man that tightly. Men just didn't think that way about other men. If nothing else, it sure sounded interesting.
"You're not screwing around, are you?" he had to ask.
"That's not my way, man," Kelly assured him. "My rules. It's for information purposes only, and it's a quiet meet, okay?"
"You know, anybody else, I'd probably say come right in here, and that would be it. But I'll play along with you. You did break the Gooding case open for me. We got him, you know. Life plus 30. I owe you for that. Okay, I'll play along for now. Fair enough?"
Thanks.
What's your schedule like?
Working late shift this week.
It was just after 4 in the afternoon, and Allen had just come on duty. He didn't know that Kelly had called 3 times that day already without leaving a message.
I get off around midnight, 1 o'clock, like that. It depends on the night, he explained. Some are busier than others. Tomorrow night, I'll pick you up at the front door. We can have a little supper together.
Allen frowned. This was like a James Bond movie, secret agent crap. But he did know Kelly to be a serious man, even if he didn't know squat about police work.
See you then, sport.
Thanks, Frank. Bye.
The line clicked off, and Allen went back to work, making a note on his desk calendar.
Are you scared? He asked.
A little, she admitted.
He smiled. That's normal. But you heard what I said. He doesn't know anything about you. You can always back out if you want. I'll be carrying a gun all the time. And it's just a talk. You can get in and get out. We'll do it in one day. One night, really. And I'll be with you all the time.
Every minute?
Except when you're in the ladies' room, honey. There you have to look out for yourself.
She smiled and relaxed.
I have to fix dinner, she said, heading off to the kitchen. Kelly went outside. Something in him called for more weapons practice, but he'd done that already. Instead, he walked into the equipment bunker and took the .45 down from the rack. First, he depressed the stud and action spring. Next, he swiveled the bushing. That allowed the spring to go free. Kelly dismounted the slide assembly, removing the barrel, and now the pistol was field-stripped. He held the barrel up to a light, and, as expected, it was dirty from firing. He cleaned every surface, using rags, Hop's cleaning solvent, and a toothbrush until there was no trace of dirt on any metal surface. Next, he lightly oiled the weapon. Not too much oil, for that would attract dirt and grit, which could foul and jam the pistol at an inconvenient moment. Finished cleaning, he reassembled the Colt quickly and expertly. It was something he could and did do with his eyes closed. It had a nice feel in his hand as he jacked the slide back a few times to make sure it was properly assembled. A final visual inspection confirmed it. Kelly took two loaded magazines from a drawer, along with a single loose round. He inserted one loaded clip into the piece, working the slide to load the first round in the chamber. He carefully lowered the hammer before ejecting the magazine and sliding another round into place. With 8 cartridges in the weapon and a backup clip, he now had a total of 15 rounds with which to face danger. Not nearly enough for a walk in the jungles of Vietnam, but he figured it was plenty for the dark environs of a city. He could hit a human head with a single aimed shot from 10 yards, day or night. He'd never once rattled under fire, and he'd killed men before. Whatever the dangers might be, Kelly was ready for them. Besides, he wasn't going after the Viet Cong. He was going in at night, and the night was his friend. There would be fewer people around for him to worry about. And unless the other side knew he was there, which they wouldn't, he didn't have to worry about an ambush. He just had to stay alert, which came easily to him. Dinner was chicken, something Pam knew how to fix. Kelly almost got out a bottle of wine, but thought better of it. Why tempt her with alcohol? Maybe he'd stop drinking himself. It would be no great loss, and the sacrifice would validate his commitment to her. Their conversation avoided serious matters. He'd already shut the dangers from his mind. There was no need to dwell on them. Too much imagination made things worse, not better. "Do you really think we need new curtains?" he said. "They don't match the furniture very well." Kelly grunted. "For a boat?" "It's kind of dull there, you know."
"Dull," he observed, clearing the table. "Next thing, you'll say that men are all alike."
Kelly stopped dead in his tracks. It was the first time he'd slipped up that way.
"Sorry."
She gave him an impish smile.
"Well, in some ways you are. And stop being so nervous about talking to me about things, okay?"
Kelly relaxed.
"Okay."
He grabbed her and pulled her close.
"If that's the way you feel, well..."
She smiled and accepted his kiss. Kelly's hands wandered across her back, and there was no feel of a bra under the cotton blouse. She giggled at him.
"I wondered how long it would take you to notice."
"The candles were in the way," he explained.
"The candles were nice, but smelly."
And she was right. The bunker was not well ventilated. Something else to fix. Kelly looked forward into a very busy future as he moved his hands to a nicer place.
"Have I gained enough weight?
Is it my imagination, or..."
"Well, maybe just a little," Pam admitted, holding his hands on her.
"We need to get you some new clothes," he said, watching her face, the new confidence. He had her on the wheel, steering the proper compass course past Sharp's Island Light, well east of the shipping channel, which was busy today.
"Good idea," she agreed. "But I don't know any good places."
She checked the compass like a good helmsman.
"They're easy to find. You just look at the parking lot."
"Huh?" "Lincolns and caddies, honey. Always means good clothes," Kelly noted. "Never fails." She laughed as intended. Kelly marveled at how much more in control she seemed, though there was still a long ways to go. Where will we stay tonight?
On board, Kelly answered. We'll be secure here. Pam merely nodded, but he explained anyway. You look different now, and they don't know me from Adam. They don't know my car or my boat. Frank Allen doesn't know your name or even that you're a girl. That's operational security. We ought to be safe.
I'm sure you're right, Pam said, turning to smile at him.
The confidence in her face warmed his blood and fed his already capacious ego.
Going to rain tonight, Kelly noted, pointing at distant clouds.
That's good, too. Cuts down visibility. We used to do a lot of stuff in the rain. People just aren't alert when they're wet.
You really know about this stuff, don't you?
A manly smile. I learned in a really tough school, honey. They made port 3 hours later. Kelly made a great show of being alert, checking out the parking lot, noting that his scout was in its accustomed place. He sent her below while he tied up, then left her there while he drove the car right to the dock. Pam, as instructed, walked straight from the boat to the scout without looking left or right, and he drove off the property at once. It was still early in the day, and they drove immediately out of the city, finding a suburban shopping center in Timonium, where Pam, over a period of 2, to Kelly interminable, hours, selected 3 nice outfits for which he paid cash. She dressed in the one he liked best, an understated skirt and blouse that went well with his jacket and no tie. For once, Kelly was dressing in accordance with his own net worth, which was comfortable. Dinner was eaten in the same area, an upscale restaurant with a dark corner booth. Kelly didn't say so, but he'd needed a good meal, and while Pam was okay with chicken, she still had a lot to learn about cooking.
You look pretty good.
Relaxed, I mean, he said, sipping his after-dinner coffee.
I never thought I'd feel this way. I mean, it's only been... not even 3 weeks?
That's right. Kelly set his coffee down. Tomorrow we'll see Sarah and her friends. In a couple of months, everything will be different, Pam. He took her left hand, hoping that it would someday bear a gold ring on the third finger.
I believe that now. I really do.
Good.
What do we do now? She asked.
Dinner was over, and there were hours until the clandestine meeting with Lieutenant Allen.
Just drive around some?
Kelly left cash on the table and led her out to the car. It was dark now. The sun was nearly set, and rain was starting to fall. Kelly headed south on York Road towards the city, well-fed and relaxed himself, feeling confident and ready for the night's travail. Entering Towson, he saw the recently abandoned streetcar tracks that announced his proximity to the city and its supposed dangers. His senses perked up at once. Kelly's eyes darted left and right, scanning the streets and sidewalks, checking his 3 rearview mirrors every 5 seconds. On getting in the car, he'd put his .45 Colt automatic in its accustomed place, a holster just under the front seat that he could reach faster than one in his belt, and besides, it was a lot more comfortable that way.
"Pam," he asked, watching traffic, making sure the doors were locked, a safety provision that seemed outrageously paranoid when he was so alert.
"Yes?"
"How much do you trust me?"
"I do trust you, John."
"Where did you... work, I mean?"
"What do you mean?"
"I mean, it's dark and rainy, and I'd like to see what it's like down there."
Without looking, he could feel her body tense.
"Look, I'll be careful. If you see anything that worries you, I'll make tracks like you won't believe."
"I'm scared of that," Pam said immediately. But then she stopped herself. She was confident in her man, wasn't she? He'd done so much for her. He'd saved her. She had to trust him. No, he had to know that she did. She had to show him that she did. And so she asked,
"You promise you'll be careful?"
"Believe it, Pam," he assured her. "You see one single thing that worries you, and we're gone."
"Okay, then."
It was amazing, Kelly thought, 50 minutes later. The things that are there but which you never see. How many times had he driven through this part of town, never stopping, never noticing? And for years his survival had depended on his noting everything, every bent branch, every sudden bird call, every footprint in the dirt. But he'd driven through this area 100 times and never noticed what was happening because it was a different sort of jungle, filled with very different game. Part of him just shrugged and said, "Well, what did you expect?" Another part noted that there had always been danger here, and he'd failed to take note of it. But the warning was not as loud and clear as it should have been. The environment was ideal. Dark, under a cloudy, moonless sky. The only illumination came from sparse streetlights that created lonely globes of light along sidewalks both deserted and active. Showers came and went, some fairly heavy, mostly moderate, enough to keep heads down and limit visibility, enough to reduce a person's normal curiosity. That suited Kelly fine, since he was circulating around and around the blocks, noting changes from the second to the third pass by a particular spot. He noted that not even all the streetlights were functioning. Was that just the sloth of city workers, or creative maintenance on the part of the local businessmen? Perhaps a little of both, Kelly thought. The guys who changed the bulbs couldn't make all that much, and a $20 bill would probably persuade them to be a little slow, or maybe not screw the bulb in all the way. In any case, it set the mood. The streets were dark, and the dark had always been Kelly's trusted friend. The neighborhoods were so sad, he thought. Shabby storefronts of what had been mom-and-pop grocery stores, probably run out of business by supermarkets which had themselves been wrecked in the 68 rioting, opening a hole in the economic fabric of the area, but one not yet filled. The cracked cement of the sidewalks was littered with all manner of debris. Were there people who lived here? Who were they? What did they do? What were their dreams? Surely not all could be criminals. Did they hide at night? And if then, what about the daylight? Kelly had learned it in Asia. Give the enemy one part of the day, and he would secure it for himself, and then expand it, for the day had 24 hours, and he would want them all for himself and his activities. No, you couldn't give the other side anything, not a time, not a place, nothing that they could reliably use. That's how people lost a war, and there was a war going on here. And the winners were not the forces of good. That realization struck him hard. Kelly had already seen what he knew to be a losing war. The dealers were a diverse group, Kelly saw as he cruised past their sales area. Their posture told him of their confidence. They owned the streets at this hour. There might be competition from one to the other, a nasty Darwinian process that determined who owned what segment of what sidewalk, who had territorial rights in front of this or that broken window. But, as with all such competition, things would soon attain some sort of stability, and business would be conducted, because the purpose of the competition was business after all. He turned right onto a new street. The thought evoked a grunt and a thin, ironic smile. New Street? No, these streets were old ones. So old that good people had left them years ago to move out of the city into greener places, allowing other people, deemed less valuable than themselves, to move in. And then they too had moved away, and the cycle had continued for another few generations until something had gone very badly wrong to create what he saw now in this place. It had taken an hour or so for him to grasp the fact that there were people here, not just trash-laden sidewalks and criminals. He saw a woman leading a child by the hand away from a bus stop. He wondered where they were returning from. A visit with an aunt? The public library? Some place whose attractions were worth the uncomfortable passage between the bus stop and home, past sights and sounds and people whose very existence could damage that little child. Kelly's back got straighter and his eyes narrower. He'd seen that before. Even in Vietnam, a country at war since before his birth, there were still parents and children, and even in war, a desperate quest for something like normality. Children needed to play some of the time, to be held and loved, protected from the harsher aspects of reality for as long as the courage and talents of their parents could make that possible. And it was true here, too. Everywhere there were victims, all innocent to some greater or lesser degree, and the children the most innocent of all. He could see it there, 50 yards away, as the young mother led her child across the street, short of the corner where a dealer stood, making a transaction. Kelly slowed his car to allow her safe passage, hoping that the care and love she showed that night would make a difference to her child. Did the dealers notice her? Were the ordinary citizens worthy of note at all? Were they cover? Potential customers? Nuisances? Prey? And what of the child? Did they care at all? Probably not. Shit, he whispered quietly to himself, too detached to show his anger openly. What? Pam asked. She was sitting quietly, leaning away from the window. Nothing. Sorry. Kelly shook his head and continued his observation. He was actually beginning to enjoy himself. It was like a reconnaissance mission. Reconnaissance was learning, and learning had always been a passion for Kelly. Here was something completely new. Sure, it was evil, destructive, ugly, but it was also different, which made it exciting. His hands tingled on the wheel. The customers were diverse, too. Some were obviously local, you could tell from their color and shabby clothing. Some were more addicted than others, and Kelly wondered what that meant. Were the apparently functional ones the newly enslaved? Were the shambling ones the veterans of self-destruction, heading irrevocably towards their own deaths? How could a normal person look at them and not be frightened that it was possible to destroy yourself one dose at a time? What drove people to do this? Kelly nearly stopped the car with that thought. That was something beyond his experience. Then there were the others, the ones with medium expensive cars so clean that they had to come from the suburbs, where standards had to be observed. He pulled past one and gave the driver a quick look. Even wears a tie. Loose in the collar to allow for his nervousness in a neighborhood such as this one, using one hand to roll down the window while the other perched at the top of the wheel, his right foot doubtless resting lightly on the gas pedal, ready to jolt the car forward if danger should threaten. The driver's nerves must be on edge, Kelly thought, watching him in the mirror. He could not be comfortable here, but he had come anyway. Yes, there it was. Money was passed out the window, and something received for it, and the car moved off as quickly as the traffic-laden street would allow. On a whim, Kelly followed the Buick for a few blocks, turning right, then left onto a main artery, where the car got into the left lane and stayed there, driving as rapidly as was prudent to get the hell out of this dreary part of the city, but without drawing the unwanted attention of a police officer with a citation book. Yeah, the police, Kelly thought as he gave up the pursuit. Where the hell are they? The law was being violated with all the apparent drama of a block party, but they were nowhere to be seen. He shook his head as he turned back into the trading area. The disconnect from his own neighborhood to Indianapolis, merely 10 years before, was vast. How had things changed so rapidly? How had he missed it? His time in the Navy, his life on the island, had insulated him from everything. He was a rube, an innocent, a tourist in his own country. He looked over at Pam. She seemed all right, though a little tense. Those people were dangerous, but not to the two of them. He'd been careful to remain invisible, to drive like everyone else, meandering around the few blocks of the business area in an irregular pattern. He was not blind to the dangers, Kelly told himself. In searching for patterns of activity, he hadn't made any of his own. If anyone had eyeballed him and his vehicle especially hard, he would have noticed. And, besides, he still had his Colt 45 between his legs. However formidable these thugs might appear, they were nothing compared to the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong he'd faced. They'd been good. He'd been better. There was danger on these streets, but far less than he had survived already. 50 yards away was a dealer dressed in a silk shirt that might have been brown or maroon. It was hard to tell the color in the poor illumination, but it had to be silk from the way it reflected light. Probably real silk, Kelly was willing to bet. There was a flashiness to these vermin. It wasn't enough for them merely to violate the law, was it? Oh, no, they had to let people know how bold and daring they were. Dumb, Kelly thought. Very dumb to draw attention to yourself that way. When you do dangerous things, you conceal your identity, conceal your very presence, and always leave yourself with at least one route of escape. It's amazing they can get away with this, Kelly whispered to himself. Huh? Pam's head turned. They're so stupid. Kelly waved at the dealer near the corner. Even if the cops don't do anything, what if somebody decides to... I mean, he's holding a lot of money, right? Probably 1,000, maybe 2,000, Pam replied. So what if somebody tries to rob him? It happens, but he's carrying a gun, too, and if anyone tries... Oh, the guy in the doorway? He's the real dealer, Kelly. Didn't you know that? The guy in the shirt is his lieutenant. He's the guy who does the actual... what do you call it? Transaction, Kelly replied dryly, reminding himself that he'd failed to spot something, knowing that he'd allowed his pride to overcome his caution. Not a good habit, he told himself. Pam nodded. That's right. Watch. Watch him now. Sure enough, Kelly saw what he now realized was the full transaction. Someone in a car, another visitor from the suburbs, Kelly thought, handed over his money, an assumption since Kelly couldn't really see, but surely it wasn't a Bank AmeriCard. The lieutenant reached inside the shirt and handed something back. As the car pulled off, the one in the flamboyant shirt moved across the sidewalk, and in shadows that Kelly's eyes could not quite penetrate, there was another exchange. Oh, I get it. The lieutenant holds the drugs and makes the exchange, but he gives the money to his boss. The boss holds the earnings, but he also has a gun to make sure nothing goes wrong. They're not as dumb as I thought they were. They're smart enough. Kelly nodded and made a mental note, chastising himself for having made at least 2 wrong assumptions. But that's why you did reconnaissance, after all. Let's not get too comfortable, Kelly, he told himself. Now you know that there's 2 bad guys up there, one armed and well concealed in that doorway. He settled in his seat and locked his eyes on the potential threat, watching for patterns of activity. The one in the doorway would be the real target. The misnamed lieutenant was just a hireling, maybe an apprentice, undoubtedly expendable, living on crumbs or commission. The one he could just barely see was the real enemy. And that fit the time-honored pattern, didn't it? He smiled, remembering a regional political officer for the NVA. That job had even carried a code name, Ermin Coat. 4 days they'd stalked that bastard, after they'd positively identified him, just to make sure he was the one, then to learn his habits and determine the best possible way to punch his ticket. Kelly would never forget the look on the man's face when the bullet entered his chest. Then their 3-mile run to the LZ, while the NVA's reaction team headed in the wrong direction because of the misleading pyro charge he'd set up. What if that man in the shadows was his target? How would he do it? It was an interesting mental game. The feeling was surprisingly godlike. He felt like an eagle, watching, cataloging, but above it all, a predator at the top of the food chain, not hungry now, riding the thermals over them. He smiled, ignoring the warnings that the combat-experienced part of his brain was beginning to generate. He hadn't seen that car before. It was a muscle car, a Plymouth Roadrunner, red as a candy apple, half a block away. There was something odd about the way it... Kelly. Pam suddenly tensed in her seat. What is it? His hand found the .45 and loosened it in the holster just a millimeter or so, taking comfort from the worn wooden grips. But the fact that he'd reached for it, and the fact that he'd felt a sudden need for that comfort, were a message that his mind could not ignore.
The cautious part of his brain began to assert itself. His combat instincts began to speak more loudly.